Levinson.
Very nice.
So I'm from the Department of Cancer Prevention and Control. I'm an epidemiologist, and my background is primarily in breast cancer prognosis and survivorship. So a lot of the examples I'm going to use are drawn from breast cancer literature. So originally, when I used to do this lecture in the previous years, I started off with epidemiologic concepts and then progressed on to cancer survivorship. But I noticed that in your September, the first lecture you had in September, that there's a lot of the epidemiology already there, so I didn't include it again. So hopefully you remember what happened in the first part of this course in the first lecture. But if there's any questions, just stop me and I can answer any questions you have. So in the area of survivorship, this is a relatively new area in the sense that it's been around for probably about the last 20 years or so. And in the last decade or so, a lot of research has ramped up in this area. And the reason is because there's a lot of cancer patients now who live a lot longer because of improvements in treatment and improvements in survival. And with the screening programs that have been implemented, there's now earlier detection of cancer, and because of that earlier detection, you get the treatment, which is fairly successful, and therefore there's an increase in the number of cancer patients and cancer survivors. So, and then one issue that that I'm going to touch on later that's sort of a bit of a problem because it's a relatively new area, is that while the data on cancer is fairly well tracked, there's very little data on the national level about cancer survivors. And so in terms of the risk factors and sort of the that impact cancer survivors, not much is known. And that's one of the sort of the issues that are being addressed in terms of surveillance that's ongoing. So who are cancer survivors? So initially when this area started, cancer survivors were considered as individuals who were post-treatment, 5 years post-treatment, and sort of and then forward. So more recently, the definition of cancer survivor is any person that's been diagnosed with cancer from the time that they were initially diagnosed. So on day one, they're considered cancer survivor, and they're cancer survivor for the balance of their life. And then within the definition, it also includes family members, friends, and caregivers that are affected by the survivorship experience. And so even though a cancer survivor is defined as a survivor from day one, oftentimes what you see in practice is that survivorship activities usually might start after the period where the cancer patient finishes their active treatment. So there's three distinct phases of cancer survivorship. So there's the diagnosis, the end of the initial treatment. Then there's this transition period from the treatment to long-term survival, and then thereafter the long-term survival. So there's a number of different experiences that survivors can have. After the initial treatment, they can go into remission and remain cancer-free for the rest of their lifetime. There are situations where they go through their treatment, they transition, later in their life, and they experience a late treatment complication. It could be one or more of them. They can die after a late recurrence. They might have a second cancer, a second primary. And there are situations where a cancer survivor could have intermittent periods of active disease. So they're disease-free, then if they have disease, they're treated, they go back into remission, and they can have another episode of active disease. And there are situations where cancer survivors continuously are never disease-free after their diagnosis. So this is the estimated number of U.S. cancer survivors in 2016 and then projected out to 2026. So as of 2016, there's approximately 15.5 million individuals. Of that male, there's about 7,400,000, and then females, a little over 8 million. And then the top cancer survivors are, for men, are prostate cancer survivors, those with colon and rectal cancer and melanoma. And for females, it's breast cancer patient survivors, uterine cancer patients with uterine corpus cancers, and colon and rectum as well. And so then, projecting out to 2026, there's expected to be an increase up to 20 million individuals with that are cancer survivors. So 15.5 million cancers is about 5% of the population. And then we were saying up to about 20 million by 2026. And then by 2040, that's expected to go up to 26 million. So this in comparison is, so in comparison to this, this is the 2040 estimate and then the current estimate. And so in 1975, there was only about 3.5 million individuals or that were cancer survivors. So if you look at the age distribution of these individuals, you'll see that the individuals under age 50, that's pretty much remained steady. There's been a slight increase over time, but not a whole lot. And primarily, the increase has been in individuals who are older. So those who are over age 50 and older. So this is primarily because of the aging and growth of the population and improved survival rates over time because of improvements in treatment and screening programs. So then if you look at the percentage of cancer survivors in the United States, this is 2016 numbers, and this is by age. So in individuals that are near the age 40 to 44, there's only 1 to 2% of individuals who have cancer in that age group. So the blue is men and the red is women. But by the later ages, by about 80, 85, up to about a third of men will have cancer or had a personal experience with cancer, and about 25% of women would have had a personal experience with cancer. So the main point here is that in the early ages, the cancer prevalence is fairly similar between men and women, but as they age, the men have a higher prevalence beginning about age 65 or so. So this is the number of survivors in the U.S. by year since diagnosis. Blue is male, orange female, and then the gray is all. And so about 1/3 of cancer patients were diagnosed within the last 5 years, and so about 2/3 of cancer patients had their cancer diagnosis previous to the 5 years. And then you have long-term cancer patients, so about 17% have been diagnosed 20 years or more ago, or longer ago. And then if you look at the age, the prevalence of the cancer by age, so primarily what this shows is that cancer really is a disease for the aged. So about 3/4 of survivors are age 60 or older, and about half are over 70 years of age. And so within the group that's under 40 or 40 and under, there's only about 5% of the population that have a personal history of cancer. And this is just another way of seeing the characteristic cancer being cancer being diagnosed at a later age. So for all sites combined, which is at the top, the median age of cancer diagnosis is at 65. And so for those cancers near the top, like urinary bladder and gallbladder, this primarily affects individuals at an older age, where median age is over 70. And then you have sort of the childhood cancers at the bottom, where the median age for acute lymphocytic leukemia, for instance, is age 14. So I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. I think the reading I gave you gives some of sort of goes through the different types of cancer, but I'll just give you a couple here. So this is breast cancer. So in 2016, there's about 3.5 million women living. Survivors with a history of invasive breast cancer. 75% of these survivors are age 60 or older, and the median age of diagnosis is 61. So about 44% of breast cancers in women occur over the age of 65 years. And most cancers are diagnosed at a localized stage. So this is the SEER staging. So we have about, the all races is in red, white is shown in, yellow represents Caucasians, and then the blue is African American. So what this shows is that amongst all races, about 61% of all breast cancers are diagnosed at the localized stage, and then 32% at the regional, and then 6% are diagnosed when the cancer is already distant. And if you look at the five-year survival, the five-year survival is about 99% for all women combined, and then lower for regional and distant cancers. Now the point, and then I just wanted to point out there are some disparities in African American women compared to Caucasians. So amongst African American women, five-year survival is lower at for each stage. So it's 94% compared to 99%. So 94% amongst African Americans compared to 99% amongst Caucasians. And then if it's regional or distant, yes, regional 75% compared to 86, excuse me, and then 17 versus 27%. And then in terms of the differences that account for the lower survival in African Americans, it's thought that this is due to differences in social economic factors, differences in comorbidities. So African Americans are more likely to be obese, and obesity has been shown to have an independent effect on prognosis. So when you have obese women, they're more likely to have poor prognosis. They have increased recurrence. They have increased mortality. There's also some results or some findings suggest they have less access to medical care, and there's also biological differences in cancer. So they have a higher rate of triple-negative breast cancers, which tend to have poor prognosis because there's, aside from chemotherapy, there's a few treatments available to treat that cancer. So these are some of the concerns among breast cancer survivors that can impact their quality of life afterwards. 20% of patients develop lymphedema, so that's the buildup of tissue, lymphatic fluid, and so they can develop lymphedema of the arm. And if they undergo, in this case, if they undergo axillary lymph node dissection, if they do sentinel lymph node biopsy, so that's when you just look at the first lymph node, then about 6% of those women will go on to develop lymphedema. So and a positive thing that has come out in more recent research is that there's evidence that if you do exercise or increase physical activity and you sort of improve upper body strength, that can reduce your risk of lymphedema. So other issues or other side effects of treatment include numbness or tightness, stretching of the chest wall, and then and the arms and the shoulders following the surgery or radiation. About maybe 25% up to about 60% of women will report that they have some chronic pain, and that can go out in years past their treatment. Chemotherapy has a number of side effects, so it can cause premature menopause. So if a woman is sort of close in her 40s, close to her natural age of menopause, which is about 50, that's a median age for menopause in the United States, that can sort of throw her into menopause. In that case, a lot of times in breast cancer patients, what will happen is that they'll actually gain weight because over a very short time period, because normally a woman might gain weight when she transitions through menopause, but with chemo-induced menopause, that weight gain is very quick. In younger patients, it can result in impaired fertility, cognitive impairment is the issue because of the chemotherapy, and a lot of women who receive radiation and chemotherapy report fatigue. Other issues with chemotherapy include neuropathy if taxanes are used, and then aromatase inhibitors, which reduce the amount of estrogen or reduce the effects of estrogen in the body, can result in muscle pain, joint stiffness, and osteoporosis. So those are all issues in breast cancer patients. And then you have use of anthracyclines and Herceptin, which can cause heart disease, so cardiomyopathy and congestive heart disease. And that those effects can go out 20 years, so those are long-term effects. So for prostate cancer, there's about 3.3 million men living with a history of prostate cancer in the United States. Most of the median age of diagnosis is 66, and 64%, so that's in the end there, 64% are diagnosed over age 70, with less than 1% of individuals diagnosed under age 50. So at the moment, most of the diagnosis is due to PSA screening, although a few years ago now, there were some expert groups that concluded that there's insufficient data for routine PSA use, but nevertheless, it's still out, it's still used fairly commonly. Over 90% of prostate cancers are discovered at the local stage or at the regional stage, and the five-year mortality is 100%. So virtually everyone lives out to the five-year mark. And even at the 10 and 15-year survival rate is fairly high at 98 and 95% respectively. So some of the concerns of prostate cancer survivors that impact their quality of life include includes sexual dysfunction. So 95% of patients who undergo surgery or receive radiation experience some kind of sexual dysfunction. About 50% will report urinary or bowel dysfunction. And then if they use androgen deprivation therapy, the men may experience menopausal-like symptoms, loss of libido, hot flashes, they have night sweats, so these are all menopausal-like symptoms. And then in addition, you have the situation where that increased risk of developing chronic diseases like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and obesity. And that's true for breast cancer patients as well. A lot of these cancer patients are higher risk of developing chronic diseases. In terms of cancers in children, this represents about 1% of all new cancers. And these are children, and here is defined as from birth to age 14. Cancers is the second leading cause of death in children, with accidents being the first one. And there's about 100,000 children in all that have history, or 100,000 cancer patients in the United States. So there's about 65,000 in children from birth to 14, and then there's about 47,000 from amongst children from 15 to 19 years old. And the five-year survival rate has improved dramatically over the last 30 years. So if you look at across all sites, this is the five-year survival across all sites, from 1975 to 1977, it was about 62%, and that has increased up to about 83% using 2002 to 2008 data. So childhood cancer survivors have a lot of concerns, because they could experience treatment-related side effects for a long time. They can experience a lot of late-term side effects. So in the 1970s and 80s, they had fairly aggressive treatments, and even some of the treatments now, they can result in late effects, and that includes increased risk of second cancers, organ dysfunction. They can have reduced growth and development, decreased fertility, which is an issue, and cognitive impairment. And there's also early death seen in this group. So by age 50, about 50% of childhood cancer survivors will develop some kind of severe or life-threatening chronic health condition. And then they're at increased risk of second cancer. So they're at increased risk of breast cancer, brain cancer, bone cancer, so a number of them. And so for this group, it's really important to monitor childhood cancer survivors over the long term for these late effects. So some of the things that could also happen is that exposure to radiation and some of the anti-cancer drugs in this group, they could affect sexual development and reproduction, and there's risk of delayed puberty, slow growth, infertility, early menopause. One of the issues that faces this group is related to insurance coverage. So Medicaid covers cancer treatment for pediatric cancer patients meeting certain criteria, but what happens is when they get to age 18 or 21, depending on where they reside, that coverage declines or diminishes. So long-term fault guidelines have been developed for childhood cancer survivors. This was developed by the Children's Oncology Group, which is the NCI-supported clinical trials group, and they care for about 90% of the children with cancer. And this was released in 2013 and gives guidelines to clinicians on how to, in terms of how patients with a history of childhood cancer should be followed and managed. So these are the most common effects of cancer and its treatment on cancer survivors. And it's important because, so these are a number of side effects, and it's important because they affect quality of life and they affect functional status, and sometimes they affect completion of the treatment and adherence to treatment. And so the most common ones are pain, fatigue, emotional distress, osteopenia, osteoporosis due to bone density loss, cardiotoxicities, and cognitive deficits. So this is a big one. Pain is a big one. And it's one of the most common symptoms that's reported that reduces quality of life. And so it's associated with depression, it's associated with poor physical function, and it can interfere with normal activities. It prevents relaxation of sleep, so a lot of cancer survivors have sleep issues, and it can increase anxiety, stress, and fatigue. So in a recent meta-analysis where they looked at the prevalence of pain in the cancer population, they found that about 59% of cancer patients will report pain when they're going through active treatment, about 33% after treatment, and then 64% in patients with advanced disease. And then in addition, you have the situation where surgery and radiation can cause nerve damage, and some of the chemotherapy drugs as well can cause, like taxanes can cause nerve damage, and you get neuropathy. So the extent of damage is often dose-dependent, and it can take months or years to resolve. And so this is a sort of long-term issue amongst cancer patients. And in terms of pain management, about 80% of cancer-associated pain can be managed fairly well in cancer patients. The problem is that a lot of times pain within cancer patients are undertreated. And this is especially true for minority groups like African Americans or Latinos. Those are elderly, so those who are, individuals who are 70 years of age or older who tend to be undertreated, and women also tend to be undertreated for pain. So there's guidelines for how clinicians should assess pain. So these are from the WHO, the World Health Organization, and the NCCN. And they recommend that doctors ask about pain and other symptoms throughout the course of treatment. So each time a patient comes in, they may be asked about their pain. And this is a common scale that's used, the Wong-Baker FACES Pain Rating Scale. And so it's anchored from no hurt at all on the left all the way to on the right to hurts the worst. And then the WHO developed a three-step management ladder, and which provides guidelines on how to manage pain. So in step one, at the bottom, you have mild pain and use a non-opioid medication with or without analgesics. And then step two is, so if the pain is not resolved, then you go to opioids that are used for mild to moderate pain. And then for very, and if that's not resolved, then you move up to opioids for moderate and severe pain. And then if you have like signs of toxicities or there are severe side effects, then they move down this ladder. Other methods that have been used to control pain include complementary methods. So there's cognitive and behavioral techniques that are used to try to divert attention from the pain amongst the cancer patients and to improve pain tolerance. Acupuncture has been used as well to control pain. Mind-body imaging techniques, massage, and then more recently physical activity has been shown to help control pain. In terms of issues with reimbursement, one of the reasons why it's difficult or why some cancer patients, the pain management is not ideal is because there's a lack of health insurance. So if you have individuals that have no health insurance, there's about 47 million in the United States in 2012, that can result in undertreatment for pain. And then again, this is really, this is worse for the most vulnerable population, so those again of low SES, racial and ethnic minorities, and women. So fatigue is another side effect of cancer treatment that often reduces quality of life in cancer patients. It's reported about a third of cancer patients, up to 80-90% of those who actually receive chemotherapy or radiation, and fatigue in this case, or cancer-related fatigue, is different from sort of that normal tiredness that you feel. So in cancer-related fatigue, the patient will report that they don't get better when they actually rest or sleep. They're just tired all the time. And then, even though it's about a third, the estimate is that there's about a third of cancer patients that report this, but the thought is that fatigue is probably underdiagnosed and underreported and undertreated in general. And one of the issues with fatigue is that it seldom occurs by itself, so it's difficult to untangle it from other symptoms that cancer patients experience, including sleep disturbance, emotional distress, and pain. So the cause of fatigue is thought to be multifactorial. It could result from chemotherapy and radiation, from inflammatory cytokines. So oftentimes in chemotherapy, patients who receive chemotherapy, that increases the inflammation or the inflammatory cytokine levels, which can cause fatigue as well as a host of other symptoms. Distress can contribute to pain or contribute to fatigue, and pain and drug side effects can as well contribute to symptoms of fatigue. So research studies, there's been a lot of sort of excitement around the fact that exercise, particularly moderate intensity resistance exercises, have been shown to reduce cancer-related fatigue. And there's now enough studies that a meta-analysis was able to be done. And there's also some evidence for psychological interventions that help, as well as the use of psychostimulants. Cancer-related distress is also a big issue amongst cancer survivors, and is defined as a multifactorial, unpleasant emotional experience of a psychosocial nature that may interfere with the ability to cope effectively with cancer and its treatment. And so it's a complex response and to the effect of pain, fatigue, and some of the other stressors that are associated with cancer diagnosis and treatment. And again, it's sometimes very difficult to tease apart all these symptoms because they tend to sort of occur together. So oftentimes the stress occurs with fatigue, pain, sleep disruption. And so in terms of how prevalent it is, about a meta-analysis recently found that 30 to 40% of cancer patients have some kind of mood disorder that can be diagnosed, although this is thought to be an underestimate. And one of the things, the reasons why you want to be able to address distress in cancer patients is that if you have lower levels of distress, it will improve treatment adherence amongst cancer patients. And then as well, you want to reduce the risk of depression and anxiety in patients as well. So in the 2008 Institute of Medicine report, this was work supported by the NCCN, they developed a screening tool to measure distress amongst cancer patients, and it's called the distress thermometer. And so using this tool, if they identify people with moderate or severe distress, they can then be referred on to supportive services. So cancer patients are asked if, in the past week, how distressed have you been? And it goes from no distress up to extreme distress. They just mark where they are. And then they indicate what the distress stems from. So there's a number of issues that are listed. These include practical problems such as housing, insurance, transportation issues, childcare issues, emotional problems, which can include worry, sadness, depression, nervousness, spiritual or religious concerns, loss of faith, issues about God, and then physical problems, such as pain, nausea, fatigue, sleep, constipation, bowel change, and so forth. And so so depending on what the patient marks off, they can be referred to the appropriate services. Cognitive deficits is another issue. A lot of times people refer to this as chemo brain, and this is referring to memory and thinking problems. So up to about 75% of cancer patients who receive chemotherapy will report some kind of change in their memory or thinking ability. So there's like problems with attention, concentration, memory, comprehension, just the mental, their ability to process information, their mental speed, and their reasoning abilities. These effects can last for years. And it's also complicated by the other symptoms felt by or experienced by cancer patients. So it's reduced, but so other symptoms that could feed into it are fatigue, depression, anxiety, which can contribute also to poor cognitive performance. And then the risk of cognitive impairment increases if the patient is older, if they have lower pretreatment IQ, and if they have the apolipoprotein E genotype, which is associated with Alzheimer's disease. Fear of cancer recurrence is reported by a lot of cancer survivors. So at 1 year post-diagnosis, about 60% of cancer patients will indicate that they have moderate or severe concerns about disease recurrence. And in the research that, in terms of who experiences fear of recurrence, it's primarily individuals, or it's more likely in individuals who find less meaning in the cancer experience. So a lot of times when patients get cancer, or when they'll report that it was actually a very positive experience because it made them change the outlook on their life. So for instance, in a study that we're doing, we looked at quality of life at the time of diagnosis, and we looked at quality of life 1 year post-diagnosis in breast cancer patients. And what we actually found was that 1 year post-diagnosis, they felt better, and they perceived that they had better mental health than they were when they're at the time of diagnosis. So there's this experience that they feel where somehow they've turned the cancer experience into a positive one. Then if you actually look at the risk of recurrence of subsequent cancer, so even though cancer patients in general are afraid of recurrence, this tends to differ by the type of cancer they were originally diagnosed with. So for individuals that were diagnosed with childhood cancers, the risk is actually of them getting another cancer later on in life is substantially higher, somewhere between three and a half fold higher, up to about 10-fold higher, depending on what the cancer was. So for individuals, for instance, that were diagnosed with Wilms' tumor, they're at 3.5-fold increased risk of having another cancer compared to individuals that didn't have cancer, so just the general population. And then if you look at adults, which is on the right, so there's men on the top and women at the, shown at the bottom. So in general, what you see there among the adult population is that there's a slight increase in having a second primary for a subsequent cancer, so about somewhere between about 10% and 40% higher. And for those with who were diagnosed with Hodgkin's or lymphoma, it's about twofold, and oral cavity and pharynx cancers is about twofold higher. That's in men. And then in women, again, sort of increased moderately, increased risk of second primary, and then highest for Hodgkin's lymphoma. So for an example, female survivors of Hodgkin's, because they're treated with radiation to the chest, they're at increased risk of developing breast cancer later on in life. Heart damage is an issue, so a lot of chemotherapy drugs, particularly the anthracyclines, can cause heart damage, and that can increase the risk of heart failure over time. So the risk of heart disease will increase in proportion to the amount of radiation received to the chest, and then the effects can be long-term, that go out to 20 years. But one of the good things, I guess, is that the risk and severity of heart damage and heart disease can be reduced if survivors adopt a healthy lifestyle. So if they stop smoking, if they incorporate, if they eat a healthy diet, and they exercise. Infertility is an issue. This can result from surgery, radiation therapy, or chemotherapy in both men and women. Amongst women, if they receive pelvic radiation, that's associated with miscarriages, preterm labor, low birth weight infants. So given sort of, so when you have a cancer patient, a lot of time you have to consider sort of their age and if they should be referred to a fertility specialist. And so things that they can do include freezing and banking of sperms, eggs, or embryos. And this should be done fairly soon after the diagnosis prior to treatment. So in terms of cancer disparities and barriers to treatment, so I think you're going to get a class later on that's focused entirely on cancer disparities. So I just outlined a couple things here. So we know that quality cancer care can improve your survival, and if you receive guideline-supporting care, that results in the best prognosis. But right now, there's a lot of disparities in cancer. Well, there's not a lot, but there's some disparities in cancer treatment and outcomes. And these are primarily important for medically underserved populations. So these include African Americans and Latinos. So racial and ethnic minorities tend to have poor access to care. Uninsured or underinsured groups tend to have worse access to care, and rural populations as well as the elderly, which are tend to be undertreated. So there's a number of barriers that can lead to undertreatment, and these include structural barriers. So this would be patients having inadequate health insurance, and even for those who had adequate health insurance, a lot of times for patients, out-of-pocket costs can be quite substantial and is a financial burden. Complexity of the healthcare systems. A lot of individuals find it very difficult to navigate through the healthcare system and to navigate through sort of the cancer care, through their cancer treatment and cancer care. And then there's like even issues like when is the hospital open, when are doctors available, so when, and then how long do they have to wait for appointment times. And then for some individuals, access to transportation can all affect whether the patient is able to receive their treatment and whether they're compliant to or adherent to their treatment protocols. Physician factors can also affect disparities. So their attitudes and beliefs, their preferences. They can have biases in terms that influence treatment delivery and recommendations. So for instance, if a patient is obese, they used to cap the chemotherapy at a certain dose because they were afraid that that if they go too high a dose, that it would have negative effects. And so there were guidelines that came in several years ago that said that chemotherapy doses should be calculated based on the actual BMI or body mass index of cancer patients and should not be capped at a higher dose. And there's also research that shows that certain minority groups are less likely to receive guideline concordant care, and part of that is due to physician perceptions and physician beliefs. Patient factors can also affect whether they get treatment. So patients can have certain attitudes and beliefs about treatments, whether they work or not. They might be drawn to complementary medicine or alternative medicine. They could have, if there's competing demands and they have to care for family members or something, they may be less likely to be adherent to cancer treatment. Their health literacy in general or their educational level in general might affect how their abilities to sort of navigate through the system, and their perceptions about the healthcare system in general might influence their treatment choices and whether they accept treatment choices that are presented to them. So this is the Institute of Medicine's quality of life model. So there's four areas that are main areas that contribute to quality of life. So there's psychological, social, spiritual, and physical domains that contribute to the patient's overall quality of life. So psychological includes distress of diagnosis and control of treatment, whether the patient's able to control their levels of anxiety and depression, their fear of recurrence, and then cognitive effects can also contribute to their quality of life. The social aspects are their relationships with their family, their caregivers, their parents, for instance, whether they have social support, feelings of isolation, their finances, whether they're able to remain employed. Spiritual concerns include the meaning of illness, so individuals who attribute meaning to the illness may do better and have better quality of life than individuals who don't end up, interpreting their cancer in a positive way. And then issues like inner strength could also contribute to their quality of life. And then physical would be things like functional activities, whether they're able to maintain function and do things, their strength, levels of fatigue, their patterns of sleep and rest, whether they have sleep issues or not, fertility, pain, and then just their overall physical health. So a lot of times for quality of life, the patient will report considerable declines while they're going through active treatment, and it remains low for a short period after they finish their treatment. But then, about 25% of cancer survivors actually report a decreased level of quality of life due to physical problems eventually, and about 10% will report decreased quality of life due to emotional problems. But if you take these cancer patients out long term, so that's about 5 years or more, at that point the emotional well-being of cancer patients is about the same as the general population when you do the comparison, but oftentimes they'll actually report poor physical health. And then it makes sense that those who underwent more invasive treatments or more aggressive treatments will report lower functioning and lower quality of life over the long term. If you look at racial and ethnic minorities and those with lower SES, they both will report lower quality of life. And then among younger cancer survivors, they tend to report poor emotional function, whereas among the older individuals, they report poor physical function. And then in terms of quality of life, One issue is the quality of life amongst caregivers who are also considered cancer survivors. And so for them, they often report that they have unmet emotional and physical support, unmet psychosocial and medical needs. So one of the goals, I guess, national goals is to, in respect to cancer survivorship, is to collect data among cancer survivors to understand experience so that they can use that data to for development of survivorship programs. And so there was a recommendation in 2004, a National Action Plan for Cancer Survivorship, that said that surveillance and applied research should be a major public focus for cancer survivors. And it was recommended that some kind of infrastructure be developed on cancer survivorship so that data can be gathered on the survivorship experience. And then this was again a point in the 2004 President's Cancer Panel Report and the 2006 Institute of Medicine Report. So one way of doing this, or one way that was operationalized, was using the CDC Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. So this was this program was established in 1984, and the CDC conducts about 400,000 interviews annually from across the nation. And so what they do is collect information on health-related risk behaviors, chronic health conditions, use of preventive services, and the questions change from year to year depending on what the interest is at that time. And so sometimes they'll collect information, but it'll be periodic over X number of years. So they might collect information on fruit and vegetable intake. They might collect information on HIV awareness and every 2 years or every 5 years, depending on the what they're interested in. So as an example, this was the core topics that was surveyed in 2007. And so, for instance, they collected information on demographics, health status, life satisfaction, emotional support, disability, tobacco use, and then risk factors including alcohol consumption, exercise, HIV awareness, diabetes, so forth. And then they looked at hypertension awareness, cholesterol awareness, physical activity, consumption of fruits and vegetables. So then in 2009 and 2010, at that point, there was a decision that there should be data collected on just cancer, the prevalence of cancer in the population. And so four questions were introduced. And they were, first, have you ever been told by a doctor, nurse, or other healthcare professional that you had cancer? Two, at what age were you told that you had cancer? Three, how many different types of cancer have you had? And four, what type of cancer was it? So then in 2009 and 2010, it was decided that the BRFSS questionnaire, that there was an optional module that the states can opt into that would ask additional questions on cancer survivorship, in addition to the four about whether you had cancer or not. And so these questions were taken from the 1992 National Health Interview Survey on Cancer Survivorship, which was a supplement introduced at that time, as well as the comprehensive cancer control programs that the CDC helps the states with. And so in the first year, 2009, when they introduced these 10 questions, four states participated, so Connecticut, North Carolina, Vermont, and Virginia. And in 2010, 10 states participated and asked these 10 questions to their individuals that were doing the surveys. So these are the questions that were asked. One, previously you said that you have been told by your doctor that you have cancer. So are you currently receiving treatment for cancer? And then two, what type of doctor provided the majority of the healthcare? So they were looking to see if it primarily was specialists who were providing the healthcare, or whether they were going to family practitioners or out in the community to get their cancer care. They asked about whether they were ever given a written summary of all the cancer treatments that they received. And one of the goals within the cancer survivors is that when you finish your treatment, you get a written, that the healthcare professional that's treating you should provide you with a written description, a summary of all the cancer treatments that you've received. And they're also, and then cancer patients were also asked whether they received instructions from a doc, from a healthcare professional for routine cancer checkups. So at the time when patients are discharged, they're supposed to get information about all the cancer treatments they received, and they're supposed to get the treatment, their survival care plan that looks at how their follow-up after after treatment. And so it's supposed to spell it out for the cancer patient how often they should be followed up afterwards. And they were asked about whether they had insurance or not, whether they ever been denied health insurance or life insurance, whether they participated in a clinical trial, and if they've had pain, because one of the issues is that about if 80% of the pain can be controlled in cancer patients, then you want to get an idea of what proportion of cancer survivors are receiving appropriate treatment. So, and I would say in the recent years, there's been a few groups have come out and figured out cancer survivorship practice guidelines to provide clinicians. And so the NCCN came out with their guidelines in 2015. ASCO has guidelines as well. And then the American Cancer Society recently came up with survivorship care guidelines for primary care providers. And so all of these guidelines tend to be arranged by topics. So for instance, with the NCCN, they would provide guidelines in terms of screening for anxiety and depression, cognitive function, and then provide guidelines as to what, how they should be treated and how they should be referred. So this was the NCCN survivorship guidelines, and this just gives you an idea of the domains that they looked at. So they start off with definition of survivorship and standards for survivorship care. Most guidelines involve screening for second cancers, assessment by healthcare providers at regular intervals to look at possible symptoms, late effects, or even early effects, and then looking at possibility of recurrence for cancers. And then, so in terms of late effects and long-term psychosocial and physical problems, they might look for things like anthracycline-induced cardiac toxicity, anxiety, depression, issues with cognitive function, fatigue, pain, sexual dysfunction, and sleep disorders. And then preventive health is an important aspect of within the survivorship guidelines. So in terms of adopting healthy behaviors that potentially can improve quality of life and reduce risk, reduce or improve long-term prognosis. So this is a fairly new area where guidelines were put out to look at how adoption of healthy behaviors can improve survivor function and quality of life. And so the AECS put out a guideline in 2012, and then the World Cancer Research Fund, which is an international group in England, they put out their diet, nutrition, and physical activity guideline for breast cancer survivors. And so in the cartoon, it says, eat less and exercise more. That's the most ridiculous bad diet I've heard yet. And so these guidelines are meant, they surveyed the literature, and so at that time, expert groups were convened. They looked through the entire literature, and they were trying to figure out how patients can, what kind of behaviors the patient, or lifestyle behaviors the patient can adopt to reduce their risk of recurrence, to reduce their risk of developing a new primary cancer, and to reduce their risk of heart disease. Okay, and this is just an example of why it's important to reduce heart disease amongst cancer patients. So this is an example in breast cancer patients. This is based on about over 63,000 women who were age 66 or older, and they were diagnosed with breast cancer and followed up for a median of 5 years. And what it shows is that cardiovascular disease competes with breast cancer as the leading cause of death among breast cancer. So initially when they're diagnosed, this is from 1 year post-diagnosis out to 12 years post-diagnosis, and this is percent of death. And so you have the black solid line is deaths from breast cancer, and then this dotted line here is deaths from cardiovascular disease. So as you would expect, when you're close to the time of diagnosis, most of the cancers are due to breast cancer. But as you move out away from your time of diagnosis, what you see is that about at the 10-year mark, cardiovascular disease exceeds, cardiovascular death exceeds breast cancer-related death. And so it's really important to take into account adopt lifestyle factors that can also reduce risk of cardiovascular disease as well as cancer-related or cancer-specific deaths. And for breast cancer, just to give you an idea, this is really important for individuals with any kind of early-stage cancer, including breast cancer. So if you look at stage 1 cancer, 48% of deaths will be due to cardiovascular disease. Stage 2 cancer, about 35% of deaths, and even amongst the stage 3 and 4 cancers, or late cancers, 17% of deaths is due to cardiovascular disease. So cancer survivors are advised to get to and stay at a healthy weight, and we know that obesity is associated with postmenopausal breast cancer, colon cancer, so a host of cancers. It also increases risk of cancer recurrence. There's decreased survival rates among breast cancer patients, prostate and colon cancer survivors. And it's also a risk factor for developing other cancers, heart disease, and osteoporosis. So if we look at, these are amongst breast cancer patients, if you look at weight gain after diagnosis, so we know that increased weight at the time of diagnosis is associated with poor prognosis. And this was a recent study that came out in 2015. It was a meta-analysis of 12 studies, and what it showed was that weight gain after cancer diagnosis is independently associated with poor prognosis. So in individuals that gained 5% or more of their body weight compared to those who maintained their body weight, there was an increase in all-cause mortality seen amongst these women. And then if they gained 10% or more of their body weight compared to those who maintain their weight, there was a 23% increase in all-cause mortality and a 17% increase in breast cancer-specific mortality. So this isn't much. So if you think about what that means, in 5% is just 8 pounds in a woman who's 160 pounds. So then a natural question that's come of this, and so this is an area of research that very hot right now, is if you take cancer patients, breast cancer patients, and you make them lose weight, is that going to have an impact on their prognosis? Because you can have a situation where gaining weight negatively, or if you are overweight, you can have a negative effect on prognosis, but if you lose weight, nothing happens. So a lot of intervention studies are now ongoing where the question is being asked, if you lose weight, how does that impact your prognosis? And so this is data that comes from the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study. The goal of the study initially was not to actually lose weight. The intervention, which involved 975 women, was to reduce fat intake. And then they had a control group. So the comparison was 975 women who were put on a diet to reduce their fat intake compared to control. And what happened in the intervention group was they experienced a 6-pound weight reduction. That just occurred. And so it's indirect data, but what it showed was that amongst the individuals who lost, who had this minimal weight loss, 6 pounds, that amongst breast cancer patients who had ER-positive cancer, there was a 15% decline in mortality. So this is relapse-free survival events on the y-axis, and we have ER-positive cancers at the top and ER-negative cancers on the bottom. And so amongst ER-negative cancers, there were 42% fewer recurrences for contralateral breast cancer compared to 15% in ER-positive cancer. So overall, there was a 24% decline in new breast cancer events. And so although the intent of the intervention was not to actually cause women to lose weight, there's some evidence that losing weight might have positive effects on prognosis. So in studies, primarily the way they define overweight and obesity is looking at body mass index. And so that's just an estimate of body fat where it's calculated as the weight in kilogram divided by the height in meter squared. So the individuals who are less than 18.5 are considered underweight. Normal weight from 18.5 to less than 25. 25 to 30 is considered overweight, and anything over 30 is obese. And so in more recent studies where they actually look at body composition, where they can measure directly the percent body fat, obesity will be defined as having 25% body fat or over in men, and then in women 35% body fat or higher. And so the guidelines for cancer patients is to be as lean as possible without becoming underweight. And so cancer patients are advised to aim for a healthy BMI between 18.5 and less than 25. And these numbers are slightly less for Asians. So Asians, the cutoff for a healthy BMI is about 23, so slightly lower. Another area of interest, in addition to sort of just overall obesity, which is measured by body mass index, is waist circumference. And so if you, for individuals that store most of the fat around the waist, so the apple shape as opposed to the pear shape, those individuals are at about 50% higher risk of dying from any type of cancer. So the larger the waist circumference, the higher the risk of death, and this is regardless of whether the person is overweight or not. So this association is the strongest for individuals with normal weight. So you can have an individual with a normal BMI who has a large waist circumference, and that they would still be at higher risk of having a poor cancer prognosis. So in terms of cutoff, this is waist circumference and this is in inches. So the for men, it's less than 37 is the goal, 37 inches. And there's a slight increase in health risk from 37 to 40 inches, and then significant increased health risk at greater than 40 inches. And for women, those numbers are less than 31.5 for normal, 31.5 to 35 for slight health risk increases, and then greater than 35 for significant increases in health. So in the literature, oftentimes the way they measure abdominal obesity is using the waist to hip ratio. So this is data that comes from the Nurses' Health Study of over 40,000 women, and these women were followed for 16 years. And so what you see here is this is the relative risk of all mortality, overall mortality. This is cardiovascular mortality, and this is cancer mortality. And so what you see here, so this is BMI along this axis. So in the first set of columns, these are BMI less than 25, so that's individuals with normal weight, 30, so these are overweight individuals, and on right is BMI 30 or greater, so these are obese individuals. And so the point here is that you see that as you increase BMI across categories, there's an increase in overall mortality. But if you then separate out the individuals who have sort of lower waist hip ratio compared to the ones at the back, which have higher waist to hip ratio, that even amongst individuals of normal weight, you see an increased risk in overall mortality. This is almost twofold, 1.9, so almost twofold increase in overall mortality amongst those with high hip waist hip ratio compared to those with lower waist hip ratio among non-overweight individuals. And this is true for all mortality, cardiovascular mortality, which is raised by about 3.5-fold, and even for cancer-related mortality, there's a modest increase in this group, about 20% increase. So the second advice or within the guidelines for cancer survivors is to be physically active. And this is known, from a risk perspective, it's known to reduce the risk of colon, breast, endometrial, prostate cancer. There's been now a lot of studies, over 20 studies, that show that you can lower that physical activity is associated with lower risk of recurrence, cancer recurrence, and improved overall survival. There's now a lot of studies that show that being physically active improves quality of life among cancer survivors across a whole host of symptoms. And there's lower risk of chronic diseases as well. So it's associated with lower risk of heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, osteoporosis. And this is an issue amongst cancer survivors because they are at higher risk of these chronic conditions, more so compared to the general population that doesn't have a personal history of cancer. And then, so just to give you an example for breast cancer, a lot of the examples are in breast cancer because this is the population where a lot of the survivorship research has been done, so they're the furthest along. So in breast cancer, that's been shown to lower the risk of recurrence and lowers the risk of breast cancer-related death, so by about 50-53%, and lowers the risk of dying from all causes somewhere between 24-67%. And the same patterns have now been seen for colon cancer. So in terms of benefits to the cancer survivor, there's been just a lot of studies done across different symptoms, and so it helps to prevent treatment-related weight gain. So this is an issue for breast cancer patients where chemotherapy causes a lot, or particularly older regimens cause treatment-related weight gain. They can, so exercise helps to improve physical ability and improve balance, and reduce risk of falls, which is an issue because osteoporosis is often a side effect in cancer patients. It helps keep muscles from wasting away. So a lot of times if a cancer patient receives chemotherapy, they run into issues with sarcopenic obesity where they become more obese and they have declines in muscle mass, and improves quality of life, lowers risk of heart disease. So how much is needed? So this, the guidelines for cancer patients are exactly the same as in the general population. So it's 150 minutes of moderate or vigorous activities. It's 150 minutes of moderate and 75 minutes of vigorous. So and it should include strength training exercise for at least 2 weeks. And then I'm going to skip this. This is just exercise intensity. So a lot of times there's research now into whether intensity has an effect on prognosis. So can you just do moderate activity, or is vigorous activity lead to improvement in prognosis? So there's a lot, even though exercise is known as a whole to have positive impacts on prognosis, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of looking at dose, intensity, and so forth. And then in newer research, there's now findings coming out that sedentary time is important and can potentially affect prognosis as well, even if after you adjust for the effects of moderate and vigorous exercise. So amongst breast cancer survivors, those that spent in the top tertile of television time viewing have a twofold increased risk of dying compared to those who are at the bottom third in terms of time spent in front of the television. And so even if you adjust for time doing moderate or vigorous physical activity, they're still at 70% higher risk if they are more sedentary. And interesting is that for survivors, even though they tend to exercise more, they are also more likely to have longer sedentary time. So both exercise and sedentary time is important with prognosis. This is a program that's at the Livestrong, so at the YMCA at the YMCA. This is administered from the YMCAs across the nation. And this is a exercise program geared towards cancer survivors. It's a 12-week-based program that's free to cancer survivors. And the point of these sessions is to build muscle mass and strength, increase flexibility and strength, reduce the side effects of treatment, and improve quality of life. Cancer patients are advised to eat a variety of healthy foods with more foods from plant sources. So diets that are higher, that have higher fruit and vegetable content. And so there's some evidence from observational studies, so that's not an intervention study, but just following individuals free living, and that better food choices reduces risk of recurrence and prolonged survival. So most of these studies are done in breast cancer patients, and there's some in colon and prostate cancer. And just like in the cancer prevention literature, it looks like it's the overall dietary pattern that's important for cancer survivorship, and it's not this idea of just one food, but just how the foods are put together, the diet quality. So this is a study that looked at diet quality and breast cancer survival. This was done in 2,000 women, part of the Women's Health Initiative study, and this is for breast cancer patients. And they looked at diet quality using the Healthy Eating Index. So diet was measured from poor, or defined as poor to better, and this is risk of death. So as you can see, the death risk of death from any cause, from this is breast cancer as well as death from causes other than breast cancer, all decline as with improvements in diet quality. We don't have much time left. I'm going to skip through this. So and some of the things that are advised is that there's a reduction in red meat, processed meat, and intake. And that's because red meat has been shown to be associated with increases in overall mortality and cardiovascular death, as well as increases in cancer mortality. Cancer patients are advised to eat 2.5 cups or more of vegetables and fruits per day. So that's equivalent to 5 servings. And then to choose more whole grain foods. And then another strategy is to choose healthier fats. So to move away from saturated and trans fats and to eat more polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fats. And these different types of fats have been associated with cancer mortality. So for instance, with saturated fats, that's been associated with increased breast and prostate cancer mortality and overall mortality. Whereas for instance, monounsaturated, lower the risk of breast cancer and recurrence. And then there's some data now that shows that omega-3 fatty acids are especially beneficial and have been shown to be associated with overall mortality among breast and breast cancer patients. Survivors are asked to limit alcohol intake. We know that alcohol is associated with increased risk of a number of cancers. There's been now a few studies that have looked at alcohol and breast cancer survivorship or survival, and so the jury's still out. About half the studies show poor prognosis, and half of them don't show any worse outcomes. So they're still working on that question. Smoking cessation is a goal among cancer survivors, so and particularly among young cancer survivors, because about 35% of young cancer survivors, those are individuals younger than 44, will still continue to smoke, compared to 23% in the general population. And then even if you go out 9 years post-diagnosis, still about 10% of survivors will smoke. And this is an issue for cancer patients because it can interfere with treatment. It's associated with increased risk of different cancer types, so it can increase risk of second primaries, heart disease, other chronic health conditions. And so cessation efforts have been put in place. And so for instance, at Roswell, there is the Just Breathe program, and this offer to newly diagnosed patients who smoke. It's free. They offer individualized plans, behavioral counseling, cessation support, and assistance to accessing pharmacotherapy that helps individuals quit. Then, in terms of caregivers and families. So they're defined as cancer survivors as well, and about 7% of the general population is a family caregiver. That's about 4 million individuals in the United States who provide caregiving services to adult cancer patients, and their responsibilities can range across a number of domain. So they're responsible for, they try to help with information gathering, advise on treatment decisions, they attend to treatment side effects, they manage the financial issues. If you look at how much burden caregivers sort of get, the burden of cancer caregivers, even after one year, the average caregiver spends about 8 hours per day providing care, and this is highest for lung cancer patients. So some of the concerns, they feel like they're unprepared, overwhelmed, they can have lower mental and physical health, quality of life, they have feelings of social isolation. So if you look at the sort of graph, even at the time of diagnosis, or 2 months after the time post-diagnosis, the majority of caregivers, over about 70%, report that they have unmet psychosocial needs, medical needs, or about 60% of them report unmet medical needs, 50% issues with daily activity, and 38% report financial issues. And even across time, even 5 years post, there's still a substantial portion of caregivers who report unmet needs. So this is a resource center, the National Cancer Survivorship Resource Center, that was established by the ACS, the George Washington University Cancer Institute, and the CDC to provide information and support to cancer survivors, caregivers, to healthcare professionals, and to cancer advocates and policy makers. And so they provide a number of tools. So for cancer survivors and caregivers, they have a guide, life after treatment guide. They provide for healthcare professionals. They have guidelines posted, and there's guidelines for delayed survivorship care. There's also a series of lectures for primary care providers to educate them on cancer survivorship. And they were in the process, I don't know if it's out yet, of developing a smartphone app for healthcare professionals that provide the guidelines, survivorship guidelines for breast, colorectal, head and neck, and prostate cancers. So I was going to show this, but I'm not anymore. So if you go through this, so in 1996, the NCI opened up their Office of Cancer Survivorship, and that was due to imperatives document where they outlined what the issues were amongst cancer survivors. So in 2015, that was your 20-year anniversary. So if you're interested, you can go to the, and watch these YouTube videos about the history of the document, how it led to the opening of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at NCI, and sort of the history of, or what's happened in the last 20 years. And each of these videos are about three, four minutes long, so they're not too long. And so the NCI fund a fair amount of research looking at cancer survivorship, and these are the different domains or different areas that are being funded. So physical symptoms and conditions such as loss of appetite, fatigue, difficulty sleeping, psychosocial concerns among cancer survivors, health-related quality of life, health behaviors, and disease progression, recurrence, and survival. So they're looking at cancer treatment outcomes, toxicities, biomarkers of survival, risk prediction models, tools and platforms that enable creation, that enable sort of research on survivors. So this one includes some survival cohorts, or the establishment of survival cohorts, studies using NCI SEER data, and testing of technology to help survivors make medical conditions, special populations. So this is disparities research. So these might be pediatric adolescents, young adult cancer survivors, caregivers and families, studies looking at experiences in sort of African Americans or Latinos, minority populations in general. And this also includes research on neighborhood effects on health. There's research on the effect of cancer and the economic impact. So this can include effects on employment, finances, financial hardship, and then patterns and quality of care. So this is just the care that's received by survivors, how often their guideline concordant, and then what factors affect adherence to treatment, insurance coverage, access to care, so forth. Oh, okay, so here's my information. I went through that really fast at the end. So if people have questions, they can either email me or come by my office or telephone me, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.